brings to mind a line which I just incorporated into this book I'm working on, along with quite a few Dalrymple quotes sprinkled through the last, the final MS just before it went to the presses. And this is one that you paraphrased. I think it was Edmund Burke, I'm not sure, but I'd probably get that wrong. But anyway, it was, all that is necessary for totalitarianism to triumph is for people to mistake its practitioners for liberators.
Yes. Well, yes. So there's a kind of dialectical relationship, because many people, of course, want to feel that if only they were liberated, then life would be... life wouldn't have any of the very difficult problems that it has. So they want a perfect existence, but there is no perfect existence. But they nevertheless listen to the siren song of people who offer the possibility to them.
Yeah, well, it seems to me that the urge to liberate or to be a liberator is a totalitarian urge, perhaps.
Well, it opens the road to totalitarianism. And for example, there's a French, one of the French daily newspapers is called Libération, Liberation. But what exactly are we being liberated from? What do they expect
exactly,
us
yeah.
to be liberated from? And that is not defined. And of course, there is no final goal, final liberation, I suppose, except death.
Salvation would be the religious, of course, idea.
Yes, but the salvation of religion occurs in the beyond, not on earth.
Right.
So we hope for salvation, but we don't know that we're going to get salvation. And actually, that kind of salvation makes demands on us personally, makes us look inwards rather than outwards, or at least it makes us look inwards at least as much as it makes us look outwards. Now, liberation in the French newspaper sense means looking outwards and trying to find a perfection in, shall we say, legislation. If only we got the legislation right, we would be liberated and life would be perfect. And I think that's the attitude of lots of people in a highly secular society. And I say that as someone who is myself secular.
Yeah, well, now people want to be liberated from Donald Trump.
Yes, without actually saying quite in what way their lives have been made by, worse by Donald Trump. I mean, I'm no great admirer of Donald Trump. I don't find him an attractive figure at all. But I don't believe that millions of people can honestly say that their lives have been ruined or made infinitely worse by his arrival in power. I doubt very much whether many people have noticed any difference. But they want to ascribe their feelings of dissatisfaction to someone, and he acts as a kind of lightning rod. And of course, the other thing about, I suspect, is that secretly many more people than would like to admit it are in agreement with at least some of his ideas.
Yeah.
But they can't admit to it. And therefore they react in this very strong way,
yes,
to him. Having said that, I mean, I do find him a rather repellent character, personally.
I'm sure he is. I don't pay attention. I pay attention to this tier a little bit. And I guess he's an affront to the liberal demographic and a sort of... double bind, because either they have to admit that people actually want somebody like that as a leader, or if they have to admit that the democratic system doesn't work, and neither one is very appealing.
Yes, I mean, they could, of course,
blame the Russians.
Well, they could blame the Russian, but they could also say, well, you know, our system has produced a lot of very uneducated and uncouth people to whom someone like Mr. Trump appeals, and therefore what is really needed is a lot more reform of all our systems to make sure that people who find Mr. Trump attractive cease to exist.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so temporarily suspend democracy because it doesn't work, because most people aren't smart enough to know what to believe.
Yes. I mean they're no doubt they're waiting their turn, because obviously the whirligig of time brings in its revenges, and Mr. Trump is not going to go on forever, and maybe there will be a strong reaction against him. I think demographically, for example, the movement is against him. You know, the people on the West and the East Coast are going to be much more numerous. And, although the American system, of course, doesn't mean that the person who gets the popular vote gets to be elected. Nevertheless, I think that his demographic is a declining one.
Hmm.
I'm no expert on American politics, but I rather think that there will be a reaction against him, and it'll be quite a strong one. And it will be a kind of illiberal liberalism.
Mm. Yes, well, the anti-FAR are doing a great job imitating their nemesis, the fascists. I mean, the anti-fascist wing is becoming as
well, I had an example of that, actually. I experienced that myself in a way that I'd never experienced it before. I went to a literary festival where there was a journalist called Katie Hopkins, of whom I hadn't really heard. I hadn't noticed her, because I don't take much notice of these things. But anyway, she is a a kind of right-wing populist journalist who sometimes says things which are obviously true and very upsetting, but sometimes does go too far. I'm not the kind of person who thinks that you should, just because you're legally entitled to say anything, you should actually say anything. But anyway, she was going to speak after me at this literary festival in Lewes, which is a very beautiful town in Sussex. And there were demonstrators against her, and they actually prevented her from speaking, and it could easily have turned nasty. I think if they had got their hands on her, they might actually have done her real violence. And we, my wife and I and some of the other people, we were actually trapped in the hall where she was going to speak. She never got to speak. We were trapped in the hall, and there were a few people who tried to get in, and they had iron bars and that kind of thing. And it was very peculiar that these people were demonstrating in the name of tolerance. And they were, as you rightly say, they were exactly like the fascists they were supposed to be demonstrating against. They resembled them even in the hardness of their faces and hatred that was written in their expressions.
Hmm. Yeah, it brings us back to the question of what it is that liberators are liberating us from, because it seems that the prevalent theme is social injustice, as if this was somehow this sort of amorphous entity that didn't emerge from human beings, from individual behavior. Like society itself can't really be seen as some autonomous entity separate from the individuals who make it, who consist of that society. So then what is it that we're trying to liberate ourselves from, and how can it be outside of us?
Well, it's a difficult question, because one certainly can feel oppressed by, I think many people, for example, feel oppressed in the places that they work. And I actually retired before I felt oppressed. One time I did my work and I was left alone. to do it as I saw best. And I tried to do my best, and my best might not have been very good, but I tried to do my best. But increasingly, people were coming and telling me what I must do, and one eventually feels oppressed by the organization, and people become fearful. I was not fearful, but I was in a special position because I had two professions. Unfortunately, the administration, the medical administration, was under the impression that I could write anything I liked in any newspaper I liked, whenever I liked, and that was a false impression which I never tried to correct, that they had. And therefore, I could earn my living in more than one way. But most people are not in that situation, and they feel that they are pawns in an organization where the person above them bullies them, and he himself is bullied by someone above him.
Mm-hmm.
So you bully the person below you, and you suck up, if you like, to the person above you. And many, many people feel that that is, in fact, they are constrained to do that. I mean, in a sense, they don't have to. They don't have to earn a living. You can fail to earn a living and so on. But nevertheless, those people do feel unfree. So I think there is something in the idea that that you can be oppressed, but it's not a... If you like, this is an oppression which is... which is very local rather than something that comes from the whole of society. But I do think people feel unfree in a way that they perhaps didn't feel so unfree years ago.
Hmm.
And that's because of the managerialism of our lives now. There's a, or, yeah, I mean, we're dominated by management.
Right, well, this is back to the original subject we're discussing, is if people want to be free from suffering, then maybe they have to give up all other freedoms just to have that one freedom.
Yes, I think that there is that. I mean, the one freedom that people really want is freedom from the consequences of their own actions.
Right.
What they want is to be free to do whatever it is that they want to do, but when things go wrong, for someone else to pick up the pieces. Well, these things, you know, ultimately, they're not compatible. And he who pays the piper calls the tune.
Right.
And,
yeah.
And what we want really is for someone else to pay the piper, but not to call the tune. And I don't think that's possible.
Yeah, so it's like, people, in order for people to be free of the consequences of their actions, the only way for that to work, as in for the state to pick up the pieces, is if they go along with the state's own wishes and decrees and basically imitate the desires or adopt the desires that they're being socially and culturally conditioned to have.
Well, yes, but it's not only the state, it's even private organizations do the same. It's not just the state. Private organizations are the same, and possibly one shouldn't... I mean, I can't say that I myself have the solution to this particular problem, and no doubt people have to compromise and so on. I personally have been had an extremely fortunate life in that I don't feel I've had to knuckle under all that much. Or at least I haven't had to accept authority that I didn't really believe in. When I was a young doctor, I was under the authority of older, more experienced doctors, but I believed in their authority. I believed that their authority was a genuine and worthy authority.
Hmm.
I think people increasingly feel that they're subjected to authority which is not worthy in that way.
Yes, I think they're probably right about that. But like yourself, I also feel I've had a very fortunate life, despite it being packed, jam-packed with suffering. I mean, I've been dealt a full deck in terms of afflictions, physical afflictions, and emotional and moral and all the rest of it. But not quite on the level of Job, by any means. But perhaps those two things go hand in hand. Because yeah, I've also been free to I won't say do what I want, because I don't think I'm free, as D.H. Lawrence said, not D.H. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia says, I'm not free to want what I want, but in terms of at least finding my own way in life, that's been the case throughout my life.
Yeah. Well, for example, my suffering, such as it has been, at any rate since after my childhood, has been self-inflicted, which in a way is a sign of privilege that nobody's really done very much to me that has caused me to suffer. I've done very stupid and wrong things, but they are my own things that I've done. They haven't been, I don't even feel I've been constrained or forced or encouraged or blackmailed into things that I didn't want to do. Unfortunately, the things that I've done wrong, I've done myself.
Yeah, I would say the same, although I would deprive a proviso that I don't feel I can separate my self-destructive behaviours from that time where I was helpless, as in from the childhood time where whatever things
yes,
were done to
yes,
me.
Yes, I think that's true. But there's a wonderful letter by Chekhov, who when he was about 26, I think it was, where he says, that he was forced to do things that he didn't want to do as a child, and he was made into a hypocrite and to cringe and so on and so forth. But gradually, he said, I squeezed this out of myself until I woke up one day and I was a free man. And it's a very moving letter. But increasingly, anyway, or I don't know whether it's increasingly, but certainly people are discouraged from thinking. I think they're actively discouraged from thinking in that way, in Chekhov's way, that they come to think of their misfortunes as a destiny that is imposed on them from outside. Now, of course, there are people who suffer from suffer terrible things as a result of what other people do to them or fate or whatever it is. There are such people. But one of the things I don't know whether I discovered it, but I found it that a great deal of modern suffering, anyway, is self-inflicted. And not only is it self-inflicted, but the most a minimal reflection would have told the person that the way he was behaving would result in suffering. So that in a real sense it was self-inflicted. And then the reason they continued was because they were not willing to give up the pleasures or whatever it was that naturally resulted in that suffering. They were not strong enough to do so, or not willing to do so.
Well, this is a question my mother always used to ask. She would always wonder over why some people seem to be cursed or seem to just be victims in life and have such an incredibly hard time of it, while others don't.
Well, what is it? Blake says, every night and every morn some to misery are born, every morn and every night some are born to sweet delight. But I don't actually think that that's true. I mean, it's true of some people, of course, there are people whose circumstances are so terrible that they are born to be victims, if you like, and they can't be anything other than victims. But those are comparatively few, certainly in modern Western societies. And what I think has happened, certainly in what I saw in Britain, is the systematic denial of agency. So that people were persuaded that they couldn't do anything to better themselves or to change their lives and so on and so forth. And I actually tried, I don't know with what success, to persuade people otherwise, that no doubt they were victims of circumstances, and they were often victims of circumstances that I wouldn't have wished to live through myself. But that is not the same as saying that they're completely helpless or uncomplicit with the circumstances in which they find themselves. I found this particularly, for example, in the case of women who had terrible, horrible men who were extremely violent to them or whatever. And actually, and this is very politically incorrect, of course, I discovered that they were complicit with these men. It wasn't that I thought these men were other than monsters, as they often were, but the fact is that the women were complicit with them. And I thought that I had to say that to them in order that they could take thought and decide to do something about it, because if they're not complicit, if they're just kind of squashed cabbage leaves, what can they do to improve their lives? They can't do anything to improve their lives. Or at least they wait for salvation from outside. Well, I can tell you, anyone who had any dealings with British social services, if anyone is waiting for salvation from British social services, he'll be waiting a very long time.
Mm-hmm. Right, it's back to that turning the state into one's god again. It's really not going to work out too well. But I suppose God's kind of salvation doesn't provide the instant gratification that people want. It's not necessarily a tangible thing. It is a call
to discipline and to difficulty, actually.
Self-sacrifice and assumption of responsibility. I mean, even to the extreme of religious doctrine, which essentially says, I brought it on myself because I'm a sinner, which, of course, is the very inverse of the present sort of ideological framework.
Well, I think that view can be carried too far as well.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Like there was where I live is next door but three to a very old house which was inhabited by a Puritan divine called Richard Baxter. And Richard Baxter, he mellowed with age, but at one time he believed that unbaptized children went straight to hell because they were... Because they were tainted by original sin and hadn't been washed clean of their original sin by baptism. Well, I really think that is a little hard.
Yeah.
And in fact, he wasn't very popular when he enunciated that doctrine to his congregation. In fact, they threw bricks at him. So I think it can be taken too far.
Yeah, of course.
Thank you.
Well, I mean, this, I think this speaks to the secular problem as well. I'd say that we're talking around the psychological problem, which is, you know, we're not responsible for the abuses that were done to us as children, whether they're abuses of neglect or actual, you know, positive abuses, as it were. We're not responsible for that. Like, we can't take responsibility for the things that were done to us, that imprinted us, and in some cases these are so extreme, as I'm sure you know in your own experience. And I work in a thrift store. I'm not practicing as a psychiatrist or anything. I'm just serving people good clothes, and a lot of our customers are homeless, drug addicts, and so on and so forth. And I've learned to recognize through my own self-examination also the symptoms of childhood trauma. And fortunately in my own case, I had the tool set to work with that trauma rather than just let it completely possess me. But I see every day, I see people who are utterly possessed by the things that were done to them unconsciously and are simply locked into these compulsive behaviors that are entirely self-destructive. And it's not reasonable to really just, I don't think, to say to those people or to really think, well, you have a choice here, even though one can't take it away from them either. You see what I mean? There's a sort of, it's an almost invisible middle area between those two things of acknowledging that a person who's severely traumatized barely has any autonomy, while at the same time not completely erasing the possibility of grace, or whatever we would call it in a secular sense, that there is, that awareness itself can change one's situation.
Yes. Well, yes. I mean, obviously, there's a kind of gradation, and you need judgment. You need judgment, and where you need judgment, you can misjudge. So you could become unduly censorious, but on the other hand, you can become unduly not forgiving, but
indulgent.
Indulgent, yes, and that is. That is not being good to a person. It's actually you're probably being indulgent, overindulgent, to preserve your sense of yourself as a good person. So actually, you are yourself indulging yourself, and it's much harder to confront people actually with the degree to which they are responsible for their own situation, than to just say, oh, poor thing, you can't help it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you say, poor thing, you can't help it to someone, then of course that person will naturally say, well, if I can't help myself, then you have to help me. And you may not have the means. It may not be realistic for them to expect you to help. And because in fact they are responsible, at least to a degree, and to a very important degree, for their own misfortunes. So if you absolve people of all responsibility, in fact you begin to dehumanize them. Now, of course, again, it's a matter of judgment, but in our societies, most people have an important degree of responsibility for their own situation. Most, not all.
Yeah, well, I mean, there is something about a slight water to a plant, maybe, that if we treat people as responsible, they will become more aware of the possibility of being responsible, if not become more responsible. So, I mean, a very easy, obvious example is a panhandler on the street, which, I mean, I was one myself for several years or a couple of years, because I went from being very rich from being completely penniless by choice, and so I know what it is to be a panhandler, and I was quite aggressive about it too, but be that as it may, now that I'm neither rich nor poor, but just, you know, self-sufficient, and so to speak, whenever I encounter somebody who's asking for change, I'm aware myself that giving them what they're asking for, A, isn't necessarily the thing that's going to help them, and B, is a way for me to actually avoid interaction with that person.
Yes, although I must say I tend, well, it depends on what the person is like, but I tend to give, I'm slightly sentimental here, but I tend to give people a bit of money because I think, well, whatever they've done, even if they deserve to be in this condition, it can't be much fun being in that condition, and they would probably prefer that passers-by gave them money to passers-by not giving them money. So I'm a bit sentimental like that. But I recognise, of course, it's perfectly true that giving money to people may not be the best thing to do for them.
Well, it's more, I mean, obviously, that is one of the points I made, but the subtler point was that what we all need as human beings is human interaction, is interaction with one another, like the original basis of society before it became this Fabianized control system that I feel we're trapped in now, was simply that, human beings interacting. And so I try to be aware of myself, like how much am I letting myself be open to a human interaction now, and not just kind of responding to the cues and letting my own guilt or sentimentality or anxiety dictate my interaction with this person. So I would make an effort to, rather than give them money, just stop and talk to them and spend a few minutes talking to them, and then maybe give them money or whatever. But, you know, just to sort of change the framework that has been created for that interaction.
Well, I would agree with that, but I must confess that sometimes I don't have the time or the inclination to do that, and so I suppose my very small amount of money is a kind of shorthand for that. Is supposed to be a kind of shorthand for that. And actually, I feel. That one should ask. I've often wanted to ask people who are asking for money in the street, how have you got to this pass?
Yeah, they might feel insulted.
They might feel insulted, yes, so I don't do it.
Yeah.
And also I often don't feel I have the time, but they might feel insulted and they might feel they're being condescended to or whatever. But on the other hand, if they're putting themselves in your way and demanding money, they can hardly, I suppose, complain if you speak to them.
No, but of course they might say now that it's a lifestyle choice, which ironically it was in my case. So.
Yes, well, it might be. That's all well and good, although I find it very difficult to believe that the majority of people living on the streets are living there as a straightforward lifestyle choice. I don't know, you would know better than I, because I've never lived like that, but I doubt that many of them thought, well, what shall I do next? Shall I apply for that job, or shall I go and sleep in a doorway and ask passers-by for money? I don't know. Maybe there are such people. Certainly in my youth, I mean, I'm old enough to remember the last days of the genuine tramp. That is to say, that the gentlemen of the road who used to travel up and down the road, who were not schizophrenics, they were not, it was for them, it was a choice. And in a certain way, I admired them for making that choice. For them, freedom really was very, very important. But mostly now, I think that people who are not in the formal economy or are homeless, I don't think they're in that category.
No, I would agree with that. Although I do hear about people in London that are quite well-to-do, and they have their tramp outfits and they put them on and they go to work on the metro, on the underground, and then...
Is that true, or is it an urban myth?
You've heard it too?
Well, I've heard people say, oh, you know, they've got their little patch, they're out there, they get a lot of money, and then they go home in their Mercedes. But I'm very reluctant to believe that.
You'd think one could tell the difference. So.
Yes. I think that most people who are on the streets begging are not having a very good life and would prefer some other form of life. Some sympathy is due to them, even if they brought it all on themselves. Because I don't believe that you should not sympathize with people who have brought things on themselves. This is one of the horrible things about modern compassion. People feel that they can only be compassionate towards people, towards others who are victims and pure victims.
Right.
And therefore, what they do is turn anybody who is suffering into a pure victim, when in fact, most people who are suffering are not pure victims. They're partially complicit in whatever it is that has caused them to suffer.
Yeah, that's a very narrow view. If you think of something like Crime and Punishment, and probably all great art to some extent, has its goal to elicit sympathy for the unsympathetic.
Yes. But as we've got a very sentimental view. I mean, we divide the world into the victim and the perpetrator. The perpetrator is a very small group of people. We can hate those people. The victim is the person who is suffering in some way. And we don't feel that we can compassionate with that person unless he is utterly without blame. And so we pretend that people are utterly without blame.
Mm.
In order that we can display our compassion towards them, or we're free to display our compassion towards them.
Right, and then that perhaps that creates a corresponding need for the opposite class of utterly blameful.
To
have to create a word there.
Yes.
Know how to say it, but the scapegoat essentially.
The scapegoat, and to whom no humanity is due, of course, because mm-hmm. they are vile. So usually what you find is that on the other side, of the reverse of sentimentality is often brutality. And you can be brutal to people whom you hate, if you like, the 1% who are allegedly making the lives of 99% hell.
Yes, well, that was definitely where I was going. Are you familiar with the alt-right so-called movement in the US?
Well, I've heard of it, and I haven't really examined it very closely.
Mm.
But, I mean, this idea that there is a small group of people who are responsible for all the ills of the world is a very old one, and is a very dangerous one, in my view.
I would agree, but of course an idea being dangerous doesn't mean it's true, but it also doesn't mean it's untrue either. So
yes, but most of what goes on is not a conspiracy. Things fall out in that way without anyone ever having really intended them to fall out that way, I think. Mostly.
I'm glad you added that, I think, because it's really hard to know.
There are conspiracies. No doubt there are conspiracies. But I don't think conspiracy explains the whole state of the world.
That's a characteristic worldview of the alt-right, I would say. That's why I brought them up. So you've got Alex Jones on the one hand, you've got David Icke on the other, who's talking about non-human reptilians. But essentially, yeah, it's a unified conspiracy theory that accounts for everything that happens on the planet, you know, down to you and I having this Skype call, probably. And you know, it's a religious view. Like, in terms of religiously speaking, yeah, God is behind everything, and then Satan is the prince of this world and so there's certainly a long tradition for believing that events on the world are being manipulated against human interests with the permission of God, and so on and so forth. And then, the, of course, there's, you know, at a more pragmatic or historical level of deep politics, we know that conspiracies have driven history throughout history to whatever degree they exist. And so it's like there's this very large area between the sort of metaphysical religious view of everything is being controlled and the parapolitical understanding that there is a level of control in society that isn't being acknowledged by many people. And that in-between area then gets filled in by all of these gonzo speculators, let's say, theorists, and they're becoming more and more, through the internet, becoming more and more vocal, and even to some extent some sort of movement. And yeah, it is a dangerous one. Partly, I think, because it is speaking to a need or a desire, and a vacuum, let's say, because the mainstream media, and I mean, this is why it's such a pleasant surprise to find yourself, because you're somebody who's very highly esteemed, British society and Dutch society, particularly, and a very serious social analysis and cultural critic and so on and so forth, who is addressing, I would say, some of the really deep social and cultural problems that I've been investigating as a, you know, not quite a conspiracy theorist, as I say. My focus is on social engineering as a much more subtle thing, but that definitely overlaps with some of the, you know, the more rigorous kind of conspiracy research. And as I say, these interpretations or some of these facts or some of these events are not being looked at generally, not just in the mainstream media, although of course now with someone like Alex Jones they kind of are, but I mean among the intelligentsia, and become the more serious cultural critics tend to shy away even from the word conspiracy.
It's obvious that there are conspiracies, but as I said, I don't think there is the conspiracy. One probably have been involved in small-scale conspiracies myself, for example, to have someone appointed to a position. Mm. You speak to other people involved, and you try and get someone appointed to a position, and I suppose you could call that a conspiracy. Mm-hmm. Entering a conspiracy.
It has a criminal connotation, doesn't it? Conspiracy, I think.
Yes, or at least something illicit. Mm. But when you try and get someone appointed that you think you may genuinely think that he's the best person to be appointed and all the rest of it, and perhaps he actually is the best person, but you're not going through the approved channels, you're not going through the openly approved channels and the correct procedures and so forth. And if I take, for example, when I started working in the prison as a doctor, I happened to know the doctor who was in charge of the medical services in the prison, and I'd worked with him very briefly before. He knew I was reasonably competent and so on and so forth, and we got on reasonably well. So he just asked me, would I work with him? And I said, yes. Well, nobody's appointed like that now. Mm. on this personal basis, which could in a sense be regarded as on a very tiny scale a conspiracy, because it wasn't the approved method of approving someone or of taking someone on. And nowadays this would be regarded as a not quite as a crime, but certainly as a misdemeanor, and it would be regarded as illicit. So we now formalize everything. Mm. Actually, that's another thing. And you don't trust anybody, you don't trust anything. And I like to think that this way of appointing me was actually very good, because I believe that I provided service for quite a number of years. And in fact, there's a rational basis for having been appointed in that fashion, because he did actually know me personally. He wasn't just relying on hearsay. He knew me. So it was, in a way, it was more efficient. But some people would say that this is conspiratorial. But his way of appointing him was conspiratorial. He might well have spoken to someone else and said, well, I know this chap is all right. I want to appoint him. And that's a kind of a small-scale conspiracy. So, but I think the idea that there is a conspiracy is false and very dangerous.
Unifying all of them together, you mean?
Unifying them together, yes. Mm-hmm. And of course, well, like any, as with any paranoid system, any new data can be interpreted in light of that.
Mm-hmm.
In the light of that idea, that conspiratorial idea.
Absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, that's...
You can never have any refutation of it. No evidence will ever... It can all immediate. Any evidence can immediately be explained by that conspiracy.
Yes. Yes. So, what I've attempted with Vice of Kings is to kind of reverse that tendency in myself, and starting with my own family history.
Once
I discovered that it was a Fabian element in my family history that I hadn't known about, and I hadn't heard anything about the Fabian Society. I didn't realize that they were a bugaboo of conspiracy theorists, in fact. So that wasn't why I went straight for it. I just thought, what's that? Anyway, and proceeded from there, sort of following threads and amassing data and putting the facts I could find together, and without, I hope, attempting to make them fit with some already preconceived theory. And I have to say, and of course, confirmation bias, I mean, the fact is I did already believe that there was a conspiratorial element to society, so it's not as though I was approaching it naively, but nonetheless, I do feel that I was overwhelmed by the amount of evidence for social engineering. You know, let's say certain ideas, and this is what's interested me about your work, and I think it might even be sort of possible to uncouple it from the whole conspiracy mindset entirely, I'm not sure, but that you trace in your work, often mostly indirect, I would say, but the harm that bad ideas can do in society.
Yes, but I don't. The bad society, the bad ideas are not necessarily to bring about the bad results, and they're not intended to bring about the bad results, and they're often intended to bring about good results, but they don't. And as I said before, the conspiracy, insofar as there is one, is to cover up or to deny the evidence that the results have been bad.
Right. So, but what I wonder is, because we also talked about how that can eventually turn into malevolence. So it seemed to me that the Fabian saying, which is a fellowship of new life, it actually began the year that Marx died. Havelock Ellis, the sexologist.
Yes,
they were Wilfred Trotter and Byron at Tavistock. They weren't Fabians, but their research was very important to those early think tanks. It was all about sexual social research. And of course Freud came up a bit later, who you've talked about, that it seems as though they began with a genuine desire for a benign conspiracy, H.G. Wells called it the open conspiracy, to implement certain psychological social discoveries, if they were even discoveries, because I think many of them were deluded, like Ellis's ideas about sex, for example, but to put them in practice in such a way that would transform society. And along the
yes.
way it started going horribly wrong, right? And
yes.
then there was that element of denial came in, and so it just progressed from there.
But I mean, they were fairly open about what they were trying to do. They didn't disguise that they were trying to bring about fundamental changes in society. On the contrary, people like Bernard Shaw were trumpeting it all the time. So, although it is true that they tried to work in committees and tried to influence people and so on, it was perfectly obvious what they were trying to do, and they didn't disdain to tell people what they were trying to do. So, in that sense, it wasn't really a conspiracy. It was they published. The other day I actually bought a book of Fabian essays, and published in about, I've forgotten what date it was, 1890 or something like that. And they were perfectly open about what they wanted to do and how they thought that it would actually make people better. And after all, social evils at the time were sufficiently obvious that you can understand why people thought, well, I can do better than this.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure I would call it a conspiracy, or perhaps open. I mean, can you have an open conspiracy? Conspiracy, in the real meaning of the word, is something that is hidden.
I wonder about that, because one of the other departure points, or the departure point for my research, is actually was my brother, Sebastian Horsley. Did you ever hear about him?
I did look you up on the internet, and I found him, yes.
Okay, but you hadn't heard.
Well, I didn't know about him before. No,
I thought he might have hit your radar, because he was anyway. But his death. There were just a lot of alarm bells that went off, and obviously his death was catastrophic for me personally, but I mean just the way that it came about and his life leading up to it, that I really felt there was something unexplained, and also the way it was glorified. His death was glorified essentially as being this expression of his free will and an artistic kind of lifestyle, and all this nonsense that was coming out that he had contributed to spreading. Anyway, and one of his methods, if you were, was to, he even took the platitude from Quentin Crisp, what can't be fully concealed must be displayed. So he would kind of openly ostentate his vice in such a way that would make it seem somehow frivolous or playful and not inherently vicious But actually, my brother did have a vicious side, and I think he did get up to things that really he wouldn't have wanted people to know about, because he would have been condemned, not to mention, you know, charged legally, I don't know. But anyway, and of course, Jimmy Savile is this shining example now in British culture of this character that we once thought was so virtuous, but turns out was the very opposite of virtuous.
I never thought he was virtuous.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say, because what was even more shocking looking back was that he didn't really disguise what he was like or what he was doing. He made jokes about it. He wrote about it in his autobiography. He was actually quite open about being a sexual predator, but somehow we didn't see it.
Well, he was able, I think, because of the infinite sentimentality of people.
Yeah.
They were unwilling to believe that a man who went around apparently doing good could be bad.
Yeah.
And so I think he probably used charitable activities as a kind of screen, a smoke screen, while he was probably having a good laugh at the world, as it were.
Yes. I think so too, but so that's what I wonder about the Fabian Society. After all, their wolf in a sheep's clothing is their emblem. So I've ended up thinking that actually their more openly conspiring goals were that was the sheep's clothing within which the wolf managed to, you know, pursue his predations.
Yes, well, I don't know. I'm reluctant to believe too much in conspiracy. I mean, when I try and assess, for example, what Mr. Corbyn is really at in Britain, I find it very easy to believe in conspiracy, but I have to control myself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry to say, I must go and help my wife prepare dinner.
We didn't ever get to Freud after all that.
I don't know. Were you going to accuse him of being conspiratorial?
I think you did.
Yes. Well, I mean, he certainly behaved like if the founder of a sect has to be conspiratorial, then he was. Yes, in a kind of fairly minor way, I think. But the interesting thing about Freud, I think, is really rather the question of why he was accepted so much, and rather than the interest of him in himself, as the late much lamented Marshal Mobutu Sese Seko said, "It takes two to be corrupt," and when he was accused of being corrupt.
Interesting. So you mean the complicity with those who supported Freud or those who advocated him?
Yeah, well, not only those, but the whole society, or at least the intellectual part of society. And insofar as what he said appeared to be agreeable to large numbers of people, they were complicit too, because apart from anything else, he again could be used to deny our responsibility for our own actions and the consequences of our own actions.
Right. Yeah, well, this is where you and I would agree then, because I think that conspiracy is an error insofar as it erases the reality of complicity. But that's the deeper mechanism of society is that we're all complicit with any agendas that are implemented, regardless of whether they're conspiracy driven or not.
That's an important thing. I mean, after all, even if, for example, if you took your Fabians as being deeply conspiratorial, you would then have to argue about why they were successful.
Yeah.
you'd have to find a reason why they were successful, and they were successful because they appealed to first to intellectuals and second to a large number of people.
That's the end of my conversation with Theodore Dalrymple. I continued the dialogue in my own head and wrote an article, which is linked in the show notes and is two parts at my blog coinciding with this podcast, exploring the correlations between Theodore's psychosocial cultural analysis and my own more conspiratorial point of view. I think that they intersect and complement one another quite well, even if I wasn't able to express it as well as I might have liked in our conversation, so check that out. Next week I'll be talking to Charles Upton, the author of System of the Antichrist. That will be on The Liminalist, the podcast between next Sunday, the 15th of April, 2018.